content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Mike Edwards for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Armchair Traveler. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the News and Observer, the Washington Post, and the New York Times. Before we begin our journey on today's Armchair Traveler, please let me remind you that neither the North Carolina Reading Service nor I are endorsing any of the cruises, safaris, tours, or other travel itineraries that might be featured in the articles that we're going to be reading. These are selected simply for your enjoyment and edification. On today's Armchair Traveler, we're going to revisit the Big Apple. Millions of eyes were on New York City when the nation observed the 20th anniversary of 9/11 last month. But the terrorist attack is only one of several challenges to one of the most traveled cities in the U.S. and the world. Storms and floods, and of course the pandemic, have all taken their toll on New York City. Restrictions and other mandates have impacted tourism, affecting many of the attractions offered there. One example, the shutdown of Broadway, which only recently reopened. But there are signs that the Big Apple is making a comeback. First, we hear about Ground Zero rebuilding unfinished after 20 years. This article, written by Associated Press reporter Karen Matthews. It was published in the September 10, 2021 weekend extra edition of the News and Observer. 2 decades after its destruction in the September 11 attacks, the work to rebuild the World Trade Center complex remains incomplete. 2 planned skyscrapers, a performing arts center, and a church are still unfinished at the site, which plays host Saturday, September 11th, to the annual ceremony honoring nearly 3,000 people killed in the attacks. Visitors to the commemoration will find a place that no longer has the feel of a construction zone, even as the work continues. The Memorial Plaza, with its twin reflecting pools, opened in 2011. One World Trade Center, the spire originally known as the Freedom Tower, opened in 2014, as did the National September 11 Memorial and Museum. An underground transit hub and shopping mall opened in 2016. 3 other glassy towers built to replace those lost in the attack are open. Cranes and construction fences, however, can still be seen around the site. And they now take a look at the unfinished work, starting with 2 World Trade Center. Planned as the second tallest skyscraper at the site, 2 World Trade Center might someday reach 80 stories. But for now, just a low stump of a building exists as a placeholder, covered with colorful graffiti-style murals at the northeast corner of the Trade Center site. Developer Larry Silverstein has said he wants to sign an anchor tenant for the tower before starting construction. Next, Performing Arts Center. After years of delays, the Ronald O. Perelman Performing Arts Center is under construction just to the west of 2 World Trade Center's future site and is scheduled to open in 2023. While a performance center was part of World Trade Center master planner Daniel Libeskind's original scheme, disputes over its budget and design threatened its viability in the years after Frank Gehry and the Norwegian firm Sonetta were tapped to design it in 2004. In 2015, the center's leaders announced a new team of architects, Joshua Ramos of Rex Architecture PC, plus the firm Davis Brody Bond, who have designed a translucent glass and marble cube. Once finished, the Arts Center's top floor will house a flexible set of spaces that can be configured into 1, 2, or 3 theaters for drama, dance, film, and music. Free performances will take place on a small stage on the lobby level. All of the components are automated, so the walls move, the floor, and the seats move, said the center's president, Leslie Koch. Greek Orthodox Church. The long-delayed construction of the St. Nicholas Greek Orthodox Church and National Shrine, replacing the only house of worship destroyed in the attacks, is now proceeding briskly after years of delays. The building's designed by architect Santiago Calatrava is going up near the southeast corner of Ground Zero and will look down on the Memorial Plaza from a perch atop another building that holds the entrance to the World Trade Center's underground garage. Slated for completion next year, the church is surrounded by a small public park and features a Byzantine-style dome and marble cladding that can be lit from within. The Archdiocese plans a lighting ceremony on September 10th at the unfinished building. 5 World Trade Center, Construction has yet to begin on the tower that will replace an office building occupied by Deutsche Bank that was damaged and contaminated by debris from the collapsing Twin Towers. The original building was demolished between 2007 and 2011, a job that came with its own tragedy. Two firefighters died in the building during a 2007 fire. The LMDC and the Port Authority of New York and New Jersey in recent years chose a partnership led by Brookfield Properties and Silverstein Properties to develop the now-cleared land as a 900-foot tower with office and retail space in addition to 1,325 apartments. Plans call for 25% of the apartments to be designated as affordable and rented at below market rates. So there's an update on what's going on in that center. And by the way, we did feature the museum and center in a few episodes ago here on Armchair Traveler. Now, in a special to the Washington Post, travel writer Jen Rose Smith reports New York City is more vibrant than usual. Now, her article was also published in the September 12, 2021 issue of the News and Observer. So here's her take. It's been a hard pandemic for New York City, but some see glimmers of hope for the Big Apple's once vibrant travel economy. We are cautiously optimistic about the future of New York City tourism, said Christopher Haywood, Executive Vice President of Global Communications for NYC & Company, whose website, nycgo.com, offers free planning resources for travelers. And let me give you that website again, nycgo.com. Haywood owes his optimism in part to the city's leadership in the struggle to mitigate the spread of the coronavirus. Authorities, for instance, launched a program recently that requires proof of vaccination for indoor dining and other indoor activities, becoming the first major U.S. city to do so. Indoor masking is encouraged. I think people are going to look at New York City as a safe bet, Haywood said. Broadway shows are returning in September, requiring both vaccinations and masks for audience members. Sidewalks and streets have been reimagined as outdoor dining rooms, and recently opened tourist attractions, many with limited capacity, offer new experiences for visitors seeking a fresh look at the city. People are coming here feeling nervous about what they're going to find, and what they're finding is a city that is maybe even more vibrant than usual, said lifelong New Yorker Pauline Frommer, author of many New York City guides, and the editorial director of the travel publisher Frommer's. But a trip to New York does take more planning than it did before the pandemic. You definitely need advanced reservations for attractions you didn't in the past, Frommer said. One place where travelers will sometimes need a reservation is New York's newest park, the artificial 2.4-acre Little Island, which rises from the Hudson River on concrete piles at Pier 55. Within the park, visitors will find a mix of performing spaces, food stalls, and manicured gardens. Free reservations with timed entry are required to access the park from noon on, so go early if you don't have a booking. From there, head uptown to the new Allison and Roberto Mignone Halls of Gems and Minerals at the American Museum of Natural History, where thousands of specimens are on display, some for the first time. Awe-inspiring stones include a purple amethyst geode, a rock with a cavity lined with crystals weighing 11,000 pounds, and an inaugural exhibition, Beautiful Creatures, showcases animal-shaped jewelry such as a Cartier crocodile necklace crusted with yellow diamonds. Timed entry tickets are required, and visitors join a virtual line for the Mignone Halls on arrival. The museum recommends visiting in the morning because the virtual line can be full by the afternoon. On the other side of Central Park is the Frick Madison, the temporary home of the Frick Collection of European Artwork, whose permanent location, a Fifth Avenue mansion, is undergoing renovation. Masterpieces by Goya, Rembrandt, and Vermeer are resplendent in this minimalist setting where works are arranged by date and region. And on October 21st, the Observation Deck Summit One Vanderbilt opens high on a new 67-story skyscraper in Midtown Manhattan. Access is by glass elevator, and Summit One Vanderbilt will have dining, an outdoor bar, and garden space. Visitors who have previously relied on ride-hailing apps might consider using more public transit this time, Frommer said, because Uber and Lyft fares have skyrocketed in the city. With some offices still closed, she added, many buses and subway cars are pleasantly uncrowded. If you're passing through Penn Station, pause to explore the soaring Moynihan Train Hall, which opened in January in a renovated Beaux Arts building on 8th Avenue. The hall occupies what was once a mail sorting room in the city's general post office. It has a luminous glass-topped atrium and vast expanses of Tennessee marble. Artwork abounds. A ceiling installation by artist Kenhendi Wildley depicts breakdancers in a painted glass triptych riffing on a Sistine Chapel fresco. Despite rebounding interest in travel, hotel occupancy in New York City is still recovering. It reached 64.9% in July, according to STR, a global hospitality data and analytics company. That's a high for 2021, but it's still well below the 89% occupancy in July 2019. For travelers, Frommer said, that means Manhattan hotels close to top attractions can become more affordable than they used to be. That includes some of the newest names in hospitality. As of early August, 12 hotels had opened this year in New York City, according to NYC and Company, and more are on the way. Well, you know, people travel to New York City for many reasons, business, pleasure, and often just a short getaway. In the few times I've been able to go there, for example, I've always enjoyed just walking various parts of the city just to kind of get a feel of what it's like when it comes to grabbing a bagel for breakfast, for example, or taking the subway and enjoying the sights away from the throngs of tourists. There's always things to see where you don't have to stand in line. Now, among the attractions for tourists are museums. Travel writer David Farley recently offered what travelers can expect in newly reopened New York City. This was in the August 12, 2021 issue of the Washington Post. Now, you may want to pay close attention as David will provide some tips on lesser-known attractions that avoid big crowds. The New York City museum scene is dominated by the big-box tourist magnets, where visitors can submerge themselves in treasures for entire days. The Metropolitan Museum of Art, the Museum of Modern Art, the Guggenheim, and the Whitney Museum of American Art, for example. But those are just four in a metropolis pack with more than 200 different museums, most of which exist in the shadow of the big league institutions. There are a few good reasons you should seek out smaller, quirkier museums on your next visit to the Big Apple. A more intimate experience, often with docents leading formal and informal tours, and the chance to see parts of the city to which you normally wouldn't venture. And a bonus, you might gain a new appreciation for a very specific museum subject, whether that is the arcane history of the city, the roots of hip-hop, or how George Washington liked to party. Now, here's a list of these in a little more detail. First, we have the City Reliquary, an old light from the Statue of Liberty's torch, a chunk of stone that fell off the Flatiron Building, a turnstile from Ebbets Field, erstwhile home of the Brooklyn Dodgers. These are just a few of the artifacts that make up the permanent collection of City Reliquary, a Williamsburg, Brooklyn repository crammed with the meaningful minutiae of New York history. We preserve objects that people didn't want but tell a different story about the culture and history of this city, said docent Jacob Ford. Started in 2002, in the front window of founder Dave Herman's ground floor apartment around the corner, City Reliquary is now housed in a former bodega space with a verdant back garden. Then we have the Francis Tavern Museum. On December 4, 1783, 9 days after British soldiers evacuated New York City for good, General George Washington bid farewell to his troops during a feast in the second-floor long room at Francis Tavern in Lower Manhattan. The room where Washington ate, drank, and celebrated is preserved in this museum, which sits above the still-operating tavern. Opened in 1762, Francis is the oldest tavern in the city, but not the oldest continuously open tavern. That designation belongs to McSorley's Ale House in the East Village. The museum leads guests through the history of the Watering Hole, which has seen its fair share of momentous affairs, including the plotting of the New York Tea Party in 1774 and a meeting between Alexander Hamilton and Aaron Burr a week before their famous 1804 duel. Exhibitions focus on the period when America was transitioning from a colony to an autonomous nation, with rooms dedicated to Washington as well as George Clinton, the first American-born governor of New York. If all that history has built up a thirst, you only need to walk down to the ground floor to party like it's 1799. And then we have this one, and I hope I'm pronouncing this right because I can't find a pronouncer on it. It's called the MZMM, and it's spelled capital M, and then little m, M-U-S-E-U-M, like museum, and then another M. Anyway, is there an unwritten rule that a museum has to be housed in a grand neoclassical building or a structure designed by a famous architect? If so, don't tell that to Alex Kallman and the filmmaking brothers Josh and Benny Safdie, who saw an elevator shaft in an alley on the border between Chinatown and Tribeca in 2012, and they thought, that space is perfect for a museum, or in this case, a museum, a little exhibition space with extra long name. It's easy to at first dismiss this 36-square-foot room as a joke or some kind of publicity stunt, but the remnants on display in the diminutive elevator shaft are political, often profound, and sometimes disturbing. They call it object journalism, objects that tell a story and how those artifacts intersect in people's lives. Items include things that were found on people of color when they were shot and killed by the police, Islamic State currency, receipts from death row prisoners' last meals, and personal possessions found in the Sonoran Desert after mass migrations, among others. Next is the Morbid Anatomy Library, an offspring of the now-defunct Morbid Anatomy Museum. This 1,000-square-foot cabinet of curiosities is slated to open in a new permanent location on September 18th. It houses hundreds of, well, morbid artifacts and books, such as antiquated medical equipment, taxidermy, funeral ephemera, and skeletons. You need not have a fascination with morbid and the macabre to enjoy this space, but it might help you to better appreciate, say, the taxidermied two-headed duckling, various rubber human body parts once used for medical instruction, or the wall of books on everything from the philosophy of death to ancient funeral rites. The museum's new facility is located in Industry City, a complex of erstwhile waterfront warehouses in Sunset Park, Brooklyn, that now house galleries, boutiques, restaurants, bars, and shortly, one museum of morbid mementos. Then we have the Rubin Museum of Art. What started as a private collection of Himalayan art by Shelley and Donald Rubin in the mid-1970s has become a dynamic showcase for art from Asia and the Indian subcontinent, particularly that of Tibet. Each floor reveals Buddha and Bodhisattva statues from centuries past and useful placards explaining Buddhist concepts and historical contexts make the Rubin an entertaining and educational spot to spend a couple of hours. Plan your visit for Friday evening when admission is free and the museum stays open until 10 p.m. The Rubin also organizes meditation sessions with such luminaries as Sharon Salzberg and Kate Johnson, among others. At the moment, the sessions are online only, but in-person events will return at some point. Then we have the Universal Hip-Hop Museum. There are many reasons to visit the Bronx, including Yankee Stadium, the New York Botanical Garden, and Arthur Avenue, a far better Little Italy than the one in Manhattan. Another reason? Well, this museum, dedicated to the history of hip-hop. Set in a temporary home in the South Bronx, the Universal Hip-Hop Museum will make you want to wave your hands in the air, and yes, you'll also want to wave them like you just don't care. It features a rotating array of curios from the genre's history, including audio samples, videos of early rap luminaries such as Grandmaster Flash, and flyers promoting DJ and MC sessions in the Bronx from the late 70s and early 80s, before hip-hop became a global phenomenon. Until the state-of-the-art building is erected across the street in 2024, the museum is telling its story in installments, currently displaying posters, videos, and other remnants from 1980 to 1985. Starting in January 2022, the exhibit will shift to the years 1986 to 1990. So there you have David Farley's piece there on some things to see in New York other than the great tourist attractions. By the way, David is a New York City resident, and he has a website called Trip Out Online if you'd like to learn more about the places he knows about. And you'll also find him on Instagram at DavidFarley7, at DavidFarley7. So there you go, some fun to do there in New York City. And by the way, if you want to go, David does have a few tips here, and I'll just read a few of these for you. Like what to do if you go to City Reliquary, which is at 370 Metropolitan Avenue, Brooklyn. And online, check them out at cityreliquary.org. Reliquary is spelled RELIQUARY, cityreliquary.org. This Williamsburg, Brooklyn space is a depository for obscure relics that reflect the history of New York City. Open Saturday and Sunday, noon to 6 p.m. General admission is $7. Students, educators, and seniors get in for $5. And children 12 and under are free. And then, of course, we had, as we discussed earlier, the Francis Tavern Museum, and that's spelled FRANCES, Francis Tavern Museum at 54 Pearl Street, and francistavernmuseum.org gets you more information online. This second floor museum's focus is on the history and objects of a 250-year-old tavern with the still functioning bar on the ground floor. It's open Wednesday to Sunday, noon to 5 p.m. Adults get in for $7. Senior students and children from age 6 to 17, it's $4. And for military and children under 5, it's free. And then we have that one that I found difficult to pronounce, the Museum. That's at 4 Cortland Alley, and they're on the web at museum.com. That's museum.com. An elevator shaft come museum in a Chinatown alleyway that exhibits thought-provoking objects in a diminutive space, open Friday to Sunday, 11 a.m. to 6 p.m. The admission is $6 for private viewings for up to 5 people. And that crazy Morbid Anatomy Library is found at 220 36th Street in Brooklyn. And online, you can get it at morbidanatomy.org/library. That's morbidanatomy.org/library. Skulls, taxidermy, holy curios, and books about death supply the morbid in this small museum's name. It opened September the 18th, and regular times now are Saturday and Sunday, 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. And by the way, it's free admission. Then we have the Rubin Museum of Art at 150 West 17th Street. Online, check it at rubinmuseum.org, R-U-B-I-N, rubinmuseum.org. This Chelsea Museum zeroes in on Himalayan art, particularly that of Buddhist cultures of centuries past. It's open Thursday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m., on Friday, 11 a.m. to 10 p.m., Saturday and Sunday, 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. Adults get in for $19, seniors, students, and visitors with disabilities, it's $14, and children 12 and under get in free. Then that Universal Hip Hop Museum is found at 610 Exterior Street in the Bronx, and you can check that out at uhhm.org, uhhm.org. And located in the birthplace of rap and hip-hop, this museum is dedicated to the genre and features a rotating array of curios tracing its history. Open Friday and Saturday, noon to 5:30 p.m., Sunday, 1 p.m. to 6:30 p.m. The general admission is $10. And if you want more information about places to see and things to do in New York City, check out nycgo.com. That's nycgo.com. Earlier this summer, reporter Julie Bessonen was tasked with doing an article on what to do this summer in Lower Manhattan. Now keep in mind, her article was written to encourage residents and tourists alike to check out the sites before the Labor Day weekend. Her story appeared in the July 23, 2021 issue of the New York Times. The Big Toe of Lower Manhattan dips into the water where the East River meets the Hudson, outlining a harbor rich with attractions. Three inviting neighborhoods in the area, Battery Park City, Tribeca, and the South Street Seaport, are easily reached by public transportation and offer breezy marinas, ample green space, destination restaurants, and a multitude of art galleries. These days, out-of-towners are in scant evidence along the waterfront, and Wall Streeters just a mere trickle, apparently in no rush to return to office buildings. This is not the first time Lower Manhattan has been down. The 20th anniversary of the events of September 11th is looming, but budget cuts mean the 9/11 Memorial and Museum can't mount a commemorative exhibit. Hurricane Sandy further ravaged streets and businesses in 2012. Damage to lives and livelihoods from the coronavirus will take a while to heal. Yet a visit to any one of these neighborhoods, with time allotted for their riverfront promenades and piers, is bound to be restorative. The first is this Battery Park City. Now, Battery Park City, a planned community built on landfill along the Hudson River, looks like a sterile canyon of mostly residential buildings, but near to the water's edge, winding pathways lined with lush greenery give way to the full spectrum of New York Harbor, and it's breathtaking. The sweeping panorama frames the Statue of Liberty, Ellis Island, passing sailboats, and the Staten Island Ferry. The air is briny and feels a few degrees cooler than uptown. Picnic tables and benches are freely provided throughout the neighborhood. Green space, Robert F. Wagner Jr. Park, Nelson A. Rockefeller Park, Teardrop Park is abundant. The Battery Park City Authority runs and maintains the area, which includes an outdoor public art collection and poetry path, an installation featuring fragments from more than 40 poets reproduced on bench slats, pavers, and signs. Wagner Park was the setting for their series of free outdoor concerts, River and Blues, on Thursdays through July this past summer. And then on July the 29th, they had the Reverend Sekou and the Freedom Fighters. And then from August 15th to the 20th in the evening, the park hosted the 40th annual Battery Dance Festival with free performances by dancers from around the globe. The festival was also live streamed, so some of you may have had that opportunity to hear it. The talents of the Public Quartet's contemporary interpretation of chamber music was on display at Belvedere Plaza just north of the North Cove Marina on August 5th at 6:30 p.m. It was free. This pretty marina is often bejeweled with yachts and flanks Brookfield Place, an upscale shopping mall. Le District, a French-themed marketplace on its ground floor, and Hudson Eats, a food court up an escalator, were shadows of their former selves on a recent visit, feeling listless without the normal workforce. And then we have the Tribeca. This former manufacturing district is supposedly New York City's richest zip code, 1,007. Actually, it's 10,007, excuse me. But dropping a fortune here isn't necessary. Pier 25 at Hudson River Park has an 18-hole miniature golf course. It's $10 for adults, $5 for children, and sandy volleyball courts. If you're feeling flush, a seafood-focused menu at Grand Banks is served aboard a docked wooden schooner, the Sherman Zweiker, with expertly shucked oysters, and it's $19.50 to $25 for a half dozen. Parallel to it is Pier 26, which opened last year and is more meditative, a habitat of local plants and wooden walkways, lounge chairs, swings big enough to accommodate adults, and river-facing counters for setting down your coffee are designed to promote relaxation. And then there's several art galleries with free admission along Walker Street, and they name several of those. And the other place that you might want to think about, while time permits, South Street Seaport. The paving stones in the South Street Seaport Historic District can be treacherous for heels and bicycles, but they add character to this transporting maritime idol on the East River. Fulton Street is lined with restaurants and shops, including a branch of the independent bookseller McNally Jackson, in a small-scale brick building dwarfed by surrounding skyscrapers. What would New York be without skyscrapers? Well, there we go, my friend. Hope you've enjoyed your journey today on Armchair Traveler and that you'll join us next time. I'm Mike Edwards, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of the program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Armchair Traveler is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any questions or comments, please direct them to 919-832-5138. That number again, 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.